Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefeo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And once again, we have Alan Mackey. He's joining the program, as he does every other week. And he brings in, come to us with a lot of insightful information in regards to how capitalism works and how socialism is a better way for working class people. Alan, thanks again for joining the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Stuart.
Alan, we're going to be getting into a subject where many times we see on the left where we call for revolution. We say that that we need to have a revolution on the left where we can be able to acquire many of those gains that we have lost as working class people. But after the American War, the Revolutionary War that took place back in the 1700s, actually went from 1765 until 1783, many millions of people, even then, back in the 1700s, they did not realize that another war had already taken place, a war on working people. And they didn't also, when they thought that that war had ended, the revolution was already just beginning. But we didn't realize that it was an illusion that we had freedoms and rights and that we were free from the British Empire. But actually, we became slaves to another empire, the capitalist empire. So our program today, Alan, is the unknown American Revolution, the revolution that began after the American Revolution. Now, Alan, as I mentioned, we can see today when we look at what is taking place in our society, we can see many changes that when it comes to our Constitution, our rights, and we're losing those every day. We lost, we were seeking to gain those rights back in the 1700s, and many of the things that we thought were human rights and natural rights that we were fighting the British for back in the 1700s, we thought after winning the war in 1781 that we had those rights. And now we can see ourselves losing those rights. But, Alan, what I want to focus on is how some of the major investments are done in war. And we're going to be making a comparison between what is happening here in the U.S., what has happened in Iraq, what has happened in Libya. And, Alan, what took place back in the 1700s? We can see that it was a very small country that was being formed. It only had the colonies that were trying to fight the British during that time. And during that time, we could see that they didn't have any system of taxation where they could be able to collect the funds to be able to finance any type of war. Later on, we could see that the Americans joined up with the French, and they were able to eventually win the war because of much of the financial assistance that they not only got from the French, but also that they received from private banks and private investors. And we can see, Alan, the same thing is happening today where we are involved in wars and multiple wars. And since the 1700s, this country has been involved in well over 100 wars. Sometimes people do not understand how many wars that this country has been involved in. But, Alan, can you see where when we talk about the American Revolution and what we thought we had gained, did working people really gain anything after the American Revolution took place, in your opinion?
Well, I think there were gains, but very limited. But one thing I think we have to understand about the banks in the American Revolution, you had French banks backing the American Revolution. You had actually there were even British banks that were investing in certain leaders of the American Revolution and what they were doing because it was their thinking that probably, you know, George Washington was going to be victorious. In fact,
right.
If you go through some of the Civil War, the American Revolutionary War battlefields, you'll notice that there are actual monuments to some of the and it's almost like, you know, almost immediately after the American Revolution was won, the British moved in to take over the financial system in this country, and by doing that, the accomplishments of winning the Revolutionary War were actually very limited. I mean, you can see all this just from visiting the American Revolutionary battlefields where these battles took place. And, you know, even the Spanish banks were investing in, and then the Dutch banks were investing trying to get a piece of the action out of the American Revolution. So all this was going on, and, you know, I doubt whether the people that were actually fighting the battles even knew about all these things. Thomas Paine went and got a whole lot of money from the French to supply the revolutionary troops, and he even started, I think it was a bank that he started with the money to finance the revolution. I forget exactly what it was, but I'm pretty sure he started a bank with that money. And, you know, this was actually a public bank. I don't know, I think they called it the North American Bank or something like that. I'm not sure.
Bank of North America.
Yeah, and... you know, I don't know whatever happened to that bank, but somehow it was these British banks that actually undermined the whole process of independence. You had all these wealthy people that fought tooth and nail to prevent the Bill of Rights from becoming part of our Constitution and everything. And, you know, on the other hand, you had people like Thomas Paine who were advocating an annual guaranteed income way back then. And, you know, these
right.
people wanted to silence people like Thomas Paine. The bankers didn't want to hear anything about this. And, you know, but there wasn't a large industrial working class or anything at this time. So, you know, workers had very little power in the whole apparatus of the government or anything else. So,
And at the time, most of the working people, they were farmers. They were people that lived outside of the towns and the communities. And 90% of the nation were actually farmers and people that were living outside of those communities at the time. So a lot
right.
of people were not aware of what was really taking place in the banking community and what was even taking place in the government, even though the government was at the point of even forming at that time.
Yeah, I mean, you can see the correspondence between some of these people, and nobody actually knew what was going on, you know. So the communication was very limited and everything, so people had no opportunity to really fight off the banks at that time. Even
now,
right now, you know, if, what
right
do you
now,
know
what?
About banking in this country right now? Very little, you know.
Oh,
all
you're right. We know very little about what we, as a matter of fact, Alan, it's done so much in secret, you know, where people don't understand what is taking place between government and the bank.
Right, and these banks are very powerful. I mean, nobody should think otherwise because, you know, if we look at what's going on in the Sudan, South Sudan today,
right.
you know, this is all about the bankers and the mining companies and the oil exploration companies going in there, and that's what this fight is all about. It was almost like this South Sudan was created just for the American bankers and the U.S. oil industry. Because they weren't able to get a foothold in the Sudan.
And, you know, and that's a good point that you just brought up, Alan, was if you consider what was taking place in this country back in the 1700s, when you consider bankers, they were looking at a new country that was rising. They looked at the natural resources that were immense and broad, and they were looking at this as a financial investment, future investments that they could be looking at as far as for a nation. And we could see that back in the, this was also in the 1700s, we see that the French, they very secretly provided money for the financing of the war and also to make certain that all the debts were covered for the war. Eventually those funds were paid off in the early 1790s. But we can see that the banks looked at that that it was future investment. They were buying their way into the U.S. economy even back then, 235 years ago. Very sharp correlation of what you just mentioned about South Sudan. The same thing is taking place there, Alan, also in Africa. And it's not just Sudan. It's happening throughout that entire region. The similarities are just incredible between this country and what is taking place in other countries.
Yeah, and we see it in South Africa. There's a lot of people that are jumping all over Nelson Mandela right now since he's dead. But in fact, the problems in South Africa have all been caused by the international finance, and they moved in very quickly when Nelson Mandela was freed from prison, and they knew that they had to buy off certain people within the African National Congress and the South African Communist Party and even the Congress of South African Trade Unions. I mean, you had a leader of the South African Congress of Trade Unions that is literally a billionaire. What kind of billionaire can lead a trade union movement, you know? But this is
right.
What the bankers do. He got that money because he was able to, act as a go-between and subvert all these struggles, and they paid him well. He became a billionaire. And so Mandela had all these problems to deal with, and I don't think people understand that at all. It's just like here in this country. We've got all these problems that the bankers have created for us. And, you know, what do we know about what these bankers have done and who they buy off? You have the Rockefeller Brothers Trust Fund. This is a so-called found a group of philanthropists that fund all these foundation-funded outfits. But what do? They're undermining the struggles of the people. And this is all money from the bankers. And this is the way they operate. And they
right.
operated like that back during the American Revolution. They operated like that even during our Civil War. And they've operated like that in every country that the United States has gone into. The U.S. goes in, and the bankers are right there immediately waiting to invest so-called investments, and what they really want is the natural resources and cheap labor. I mean, if you look at the U.S. Chamber of Congress, within months of this setting up of the South Sudan, the American Chamber of Congress moved in and told the government exactly what they wanted done there in the South Sudan. I mean, this,
exactly.
I posted things on my Facebook page that come directly from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And then President Obama issued an order about how American business was going to expand in the South Sudan. You know, this can't just happen all by itself. These people were undermining these struggles intentionally, getting these people to fight amongst themselves so they would have a base to move into that area in Africa.
Alan, you know, one of the things that I would like to just get into just for a few minutes here, we can see that we, you know, what was taking place there in Libya just a few years ago, where we can see that, that they were having the conflict there in that country where you had the resistance that was fighting the government and trying to supposedly fight for the independence and the freedoms of the people of that country. Surprisingly, when you look at many surveys that are out there, you find that a majority of the people were satisfied with the government that they already had.
Yeah,
they were
exactly.
already satisfied with the government. But anyway, what happened was right in the midst of the conflict where you had the insurgents that were trying to overthrow the Gaddafi government, you could see that the banks were in play even at that time, where before the overthrow of the Gaddafi government had even taken place, the banks had already stepped in and had started funding the insurgents. But
right.
here's the thing that was very interesting. First of all, the UN had never authorized for NATO or the U.S. to declare war on Libya. It was a no-fly zone. They took that resolution for a no-fly zone as a green light to go to war with that country. Now, what
right.
we can see is that after the the NATO and the U.S. got involved, they were in the process of weakening that government for a takeover. Now, one of the things I could see, Alan, that took place before the government actually fell is that within that government, they had already formed a National Transitional Council of Libya. They were already had formed the government while that government was still a solvent nation. They formed that, but Alan, what took place, which was so incredible, is that they were receiving financing from the banks and also from the U.S. government at that time. They were financing them to overthrow that government. But Alan, we haven't, not just Libya, we have seen this happen in government after government, and including in the Arab Spring, where we could see that we could see the same thing happen in Syria, where fortunately you had other groups who were saying, let's hold off, let's not move too quickly, because we see what took place in Syria. It seemed like the same thing is taking place right here in, what took place in Libya seemed like the same thing is taking place in Syria. But, Alan, we can see that we're having uprisings in these countries, and these uprisings are actually being financed by private banks, and other governments to overthrow smaller governments. So, Alan, when we talk about a revolution, we're talking about revolution on a global scale against the rights and freedoms and also countries, people having the right to be able to determine whatever type of government that they choose to have for themselves. We can see that this is war on the people of the world, the working people.
Right. That's exactly what it is. I mean, that's why, the G20 and the G8, they're already planning all of these things. We don't even know what they're doing, but they're planning the overthrow of all these governments that they don't like and that won't cooperate with big capital. That's the meaning behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You have all these bankers, lobbyists that are very involved in writing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, and this is going to go on and on. And there won't be any end to it until people decide that we have to actually do something to take political and economic power away from Wall Street. And that's going to have to be done, you know, in cooperation with workers all over the world that are going to have to confront big capital in their countries, too, because this international capital is so merged, it's almost impossible to separate anymore. And the things that they do, they're just doing everything behind the backs of the people. And any time that the people rise up, they got these military squads to go in and put them down. That's why we have 800 military bases all over the world, you know, to protect the investments of these bankers and industrialists and the mining companies, you know, and there's no end to it. And the U.S. taxpayers are paying for all this. We're paying for it in our taxes. We're paying for it through austerity measures. And it's going to continue, and people are going to have to take a good, hard look at this. The real name for it is imperialism. I wouldn't call it revolution. It's U.S. imperialism at work that we're talking about, and, you know, state monopoly capitalism. That's how these bankers operate. They own the entire government through their lobbyists and everything. If you look at the lobbyists from the bankers in this country, I mean, some of these lobbyists, you have outfits like Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck. They represent, you know, literally dozens of bankers, and you have other lobbying firms that represent other bankers, and they're all pushing to get, you know, a piece of the pie and make big profits off the problems of the people. That's what's going on in the world today.
And, Alan, you know, some of the other things that I look at when I think about how banks and also when you look at this government and how we go from one conflict to another and one war after another, and we see governments that are falling, but we could see what took place there in, this was in Iraq, and this was several years ago near the beginning of the war, and where they wanted to beat down any resistance and any type of support that Saddam Hussein, that he still had. And what they did is they were, again, they were talking about the insurgents and they were talking about the rebels. And then we always heard that about Al-Qaeda. We always heard Al-Qaeda on the television. And whether you turn on the radio, it was always Al-Qaeda. And very interesting when you see how corrupt these banks are and how they make certain that they finance their wars and they finance their uprisings. These are not uprisings of the people, Alan. These are uprisings from the bankers, the richest people in the world, to be able to take over smaller governments. And we can see that happening all over that part of Africa. But one thing in particular I found very interesting, and this was something that was just a small blurb in most newspapers, or either wasn't in the newspapers at all, that they had transported $12 billion when the insurgency there in Iraq, when it was being beaten down, they were almost to the point where they were losing to the loyalists of Saddam Hussein. And what happened was so incredible. This government sent $12 billion into that area on pallets in small denominations in 20s and 50s, and $12 billion was lost. Did you ever read that, Alan?
Well, I read that a lot of money turned out.
$12 billion. How in the world do you lose 136 pallets of cash?
Yeah. Well, you know,
beyond me. And all of a sudden we could see the insurgency. They were alive and well. They came back strong.
Well, look what the bankers did to a little Cuba at the time of the revolution. The CIA ordered Batista and all of his lackeys before they left the country. These Batista and these people were so in a hurry to get out of the country, they didn't even really care about a lot of the money. But the CIA ordered them to take all the money out of the banks. And that's one reason why Cuba has so many problems today, because literally every single dollar, every single penny that was in a Cuban bank was taken out by these people when they fled the country. And the Cuban people were left with nothing, you know. And people don't understand this. When Castro and the revolutionaries opened up the bank vaults, there was nothing there. They had taken all the jewelry and everything out of the safe deposit boxes, all the money, and the Cubans were left with literally nothing. The national wealth was stolen.
So, Alan, when we look at this, we can see how the banking system and how they funnel money through countries like the U.S. and other countries, we can see it's only to protect their investments. It's only to protect capitalism. One other thing I wanted to mention, when we look at what took place in Russia years ago, and people say, well, you know, those people, now they have their freedoms and they have, you know, capitalism is now able to provide people a decent standard of living. But people don't realize that really they fell into the same slavery that we have here in the U.S. and many other countries that believe that capitalism worked, but we can see that capitalism only worked for the richest in our society. One of the things I found interesting also that I read recently is how they took someone that people believed in, someone that was, had came up in the KGB, someone that they realized was a diehard Russian, someone that the people believed in was Vladimir Putin. And what they did is they took him as a leader, someone that the people, the working people of that nation could look up to. And, Alan, I was surprised that he's one of the richest men in the world. I mean, he's worth over $30 billion. $30 billion. What if it happened to, you know, the working people? Here you have people that are living in poverty still in that country like here in the U.S., and then you have a leader such as Putin, which is worth over $30 billion. But what they have done is they have installed a leader to preside over their capitalist empire, but it really creates the same conditions that we have here in the U.S., where it's not anything that's providing any type of equality for the working class people. Only thing it does, Alan, it keeps us enslaved. And, well, exactly. And now, when you look at Putin, look at our own Congress. Our own Congress. We think these people are working for us. If you look at the majority of the people there in Congress, they're wealthy folks. They make sure they take care of them. And they keep us enslaved.
And this problem even goes into the labor movement. You know, you've got a whole executive council of AFL-CIO, and they're all multimillionaires, you know.
Right, exactly.
These people are being bought off, and this is happening all over the world where, you know, they go and they look for people who they can buy off and do their dirty work for them to undermine the struggles of the people. In Greece, the same thing is happening. You know, you had this massive struggle on the part of the Greek workers being led mainly by the Communist Party in Greece. And right away, once you get these mass struggles, all of a sudden the AFL-CIO says, we're going to work through this international labor outfit that we got, International Confederation of Trade Unions, and we're going to start setting up offices in Greece to take the people out of the streets and get them involved in so-called political activity. And it's political activity that's undermining the struggles of the Greek people. And, you know, the whole Marshall Plan was financed by the banks to undermine those struggles, too, in Europe. Europe would have gone socialist, you know, Greece, Portugal, Italy, Spain. All these countries would have gone socialist had it not been for the Marshall Plan, which bought off, hundreds of working-class leaders in these countries and made them into supporters of capitalism. Is what it amounted to, you know, and but this is the way these people work. And in the foundations in our own country, all these foundation-funded outfits, you see them coming in on whether it's the single-payer universal health care movement or like we have today, the movement for a living wage. These foundation outfits come in, and they say we're for a living wage, and they turn around and they work with these politicians, and what do? They bring forward poverty wage and call it an increase and say, well, you're better off than what you were, you know.
And what it does is it preserves slavery, because that's the bottom line.
And you can look at all these outfits and see who's funding them, and almost every one of them, it's the Ford Foundation, General Electric's, their investment, their banking company. You have the Rockefeller Brothers Trust Fund. You know, you can look at these foundation-funded outfits and almost tell exactly what they're going to do and when they're going to undermine the legitimate movements of the people by who is funding them. So, you know, and you got the same thing going on in South Sudan today. You know, these people, 2 million people have been literally slaughtered in Sudan, and the people don't even know what the heck they're fighting people for.
Right.
They've just inflamed ethnic tensions in the country to such an extent that they've been able to keep this fighting going, hoping that eventually, you know, these corporations will be able to come in and take everything over. And they're going to, they've already started doing similar things in South Africa. You can see how they've instigated fighting amongst the people and hoping that the people will fight amongst themselves, and there will be some kind of, they want a civil war in South Africa so the white apartheid people can come back and take power. You know, and they'll say that it's been done in a democratic way this time, you know. And
this
is the way these people operate.
I just want to make a very brief break here. We do have Alan Mackey. He's joining the program once again. He comes on every other week, shares a lot of insightful information in regards to how capitalism works. And we can see today that here in this country and as in other countries, we're involved in wars, many conflicts. We can see that the capitalists are involved in financing these dirty wars, and the only thing is it doesn't benefit working people. Ultimately, it benefits the wealthiest in our society. And Alan, thanks again for joining the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, I mean,
Alan, what was that again?
I was just going to say, if you just look at, the financing of these wars themselves, the bankers are financing these wars at exorbitant interest rates that the taxpayers end up paying, which means that we'll, you know, like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, We will never pay for those wars in many generations just simply because we're not even paying the interest. It's worse than buying a home. You'll pay on a home your entire life and never pay off the principal. Well, it's the same thing with these wars. The taxpayers will be paying for these wars for decades, if not maybe centuries to come. The first U.S. imperialist war, the Spanish-American War, that we still have troops in the Philippines as a result of that war. We're still occupying Puerto Rico. All this costs money. We still have troops in Guam. All that costs money. This is from the very first U.S. imperialist war, the Spanish-American War, and we haven't even paid for that.
I've tried to get
figures from politicians how much the Spanish-American War has cost us to date, and not a single politician is able to tell me or won't tell me.
Great. Now, Alan, we can see that there's a correlation here. When we look at, first of all, there's war, and it can be a war, revolution, a conflict, or however you like to identify it. But you go from war, and usually after the war, which we saw in Iraq, that we saw in Libya, what they do is once the war takes place, these private banks, they take over. They're the ones that really, they're the ones that benefit from these wars. But what happens is not only do they benefit from financing these wars because industry is created by these wars taking place, but then after they invest in the wars, then they start investing in private industries. They start investing in extracting much of the raw materials that's used for industry. So, Alan, we can see that there's a strong correlation between having the wars, which we can see is taking place in one country after another, but then they take over the industry. Now, here's the U.S. is probably the best example of that, where what took place in the 1700s. Then we could see that the investment that these banks made in this country, then the American Industrial Revolution began, where they began to enslave the entire nation, which hasn't stopped. Now, we can see that they looked at the vast resources for farmlands, and now most of the farmlands in this country belong to corporations. They don't belong to private individuals. But we can see that they were looking at future investments, Alan, over 200 years ago.
Right.
But they don't think in the same terms that we think as, you know, 5 years or 10 years. They're looking at over the next 200, 300, 400, 500 years, and the burden of that debt falls on working people.
Well, the plant manager at a big taconite operation owned by U.S. Steel called Mintec, he actually told me at a meeting where people had gathered, it was a public hearing to discuss them emptying their big pond of polluted water into the streams and lakes of northern Minnesota. And now they want to start more mining operations up here in northern Minnesota. And this plant manager actually told me, he says, you don't think in the terms that we do. He says, you're thinking in terms of 5 or 10 years. We think, as a mining company, we think in terms of 50, 100, 150 years. This is what he told me at a public meeting. So, you know, people got no concept. You know, what he was essentially saying is that we don't care how opposed you are now. We're patient and we can wait. You know, you're fighting us right here and now. We're going to end up winning this battle, you know, whether it's 25 years or 50 years or $100 years down the road, because the dollars that we want to take out are what we're after, and we're going to get them eventually. This is the way these people look at all this. And,
right, exactly.
You know, if you look at South Sudan today, the United States government has what they call the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. They moved in and set up, literally, they set a bank in South Sudan immediately when it was declared a country, and they went to work, and they brought in all this, these banks. I mean, if you look at the list of banks, there must be well over a dozen banks from all these big financial centers all over the world that have come into this little country. And, you know, it costs a lot of money to fight the wars that they're fighting. You know, they talk about rebels. But where are these rebels getting all this money for this advanced military equipment and everything? Somebody's got to be funding that.
Alan, could you share, where did they get that money? I mean, here are rebels. These are, you know, poor people that have come from, you know, farms and, you know, where they have little to nothing. Where do they get these monies where they can have these sophisticated weapons and artillery? Explain to our listeners, where are they getting this money from? I mean, here poor people, I mean, they're walking around their shoulder with something that can take out a building that costs probably close to $50,000. Where do they get this from?
Well, the banks in all these G8 and G20 countries are financing the operation.
Exactly.
And these people will be in debt forever just for the money that's coming into the country to finance their so-called rebellion. And they will never be out from under that debt to start with. But, you know, millions of people, 2 million people have been slaughtered as a result of this. But here, think about this. You've got people in this country that are literally starving. They can't get money for food, but they're getting money for guns and bullets to kill each other. You know,
right, exactly.
Common sense says that there's something drastically wrong and out of kilter with what's going on in a country like that. You know, those people that are starving do not come up with money for, you know, these expensive automatic weapons and everything.
Right.
You know, and the government there is going to be responsible for financing this operation, and they're getting the money through the international banking community to finance their so-called fight against these rebels. And you don't know what are the rebels fighting for. They don't even know what they're fighting for. They're fighting against somebody else under over ethnic hatred that have been intentionally stirred up by these same bankers, you know, through the CIA and all these outfits that go in and do this kind of thing. They did the same thing in Iraq. They inflamed ethnic tensions, and people will be fighting for years because they hate each other because of ethnicities and religious animosities in Iraq. They did the same thing in Yugoslavia with the Croatians and the Serbs. You know, they inflamed those hatreds to such an extent that they won't be able to put out those hatreds for many, many decades, if not maybe a couple centuries. And this is the way they operate. That money comes from someplace, and, you know, much of that money is coming directly from American taxpayers, and it's paying these bankers who are investing and who's ever, you know, creating these unstable situations. Instability is what allows these banks and the manufacturing companies and the mining companies to come in and take over. Without that instability, the people would be united in forming their own kind of government that they want. And they're
right.
Not going to allow that to happen because they wouldn't be allowing these big companies to come in and take over. No people want that.
Alan, I'm going to take this in a little bit different direction. Once again, I'd like to mention that we have Alan Mackey joining our program once again. He comes on every other week, and we're always very glad to have Alan to join the program. He's a political analyst and social activist, and he's been involved in the struggles for working people for well over four decades, and we really appreciate Alan. Alan, you know, one of the things that I wanted to focus on is two things. Like I said, much of this is making certain that they maintain control, because after the revolution took place in the American Revolution back in the 1700s, you know, people didn't realize that there was a war that was 200 years in the making. Actually, it wasn't even 200 years. It started in the, within years of the revolution, and then we could see it back in the 1700s, 1800s, and also in the 1900s, and we can also see it taking place in the 21st century. And Alan, that is the slavery that we see taking place with working people today. People need to understand that the minimum wage and the wages that they pay people for their labor and the hours that people have to put in the labor force and time away from their families and the little compensation they get for that, Alan, is nothing short of slavery. Now, when we see the minimum wage in the U.S., what we're talking about, you know, a little over $7 and $8 an hour. Some areas we see in the political talk where they say raising it up to $10 an hour. Alan, no one can live on $10 an hour. Alan, that is wage slavery. Now, as I mentioned, they move in, take over these countries, basically the resources, whether it's through revolutions, civil war, conflicts, world wars. We can see that take place. And then after that, they bring in industry, but then they bring in industry where it's not to the benefit of working people, only to use the resources of the working people for slave labor. People need to understand it's not just here in the U.S. It's in China. It's in Russia. It's in all throughout Europe. It's in South America. Alan, there is a war to make certain that they keep people working for poverty wages worldwide, not just here in the U.S. But that's one of the fronts that the capitalists – I just want you to explain how when we talk about $10 an hour and minimum wage, Alan, explain how that is still slavery.
Well, it's they're making people dependent on the banks. You know, one thing that they did in this country – and they're doing it all over the world, is they pay people cost of living wages. In other words, working people cannot buy the basic necessities of life with the wages that they're paid, so they extend credit to them. And who are the credit companies? The credit companies are the big banks. So you get
right.
a credit card, and you start buying everything that you need on credit, and before you know it, you've got this huge debt. And they know that workers that have accumulated these huge debts are very reluctant to engage in struggles to defend their livelihoods because they are afraid of being fired. And this is the way that they keep a hammer over and a club over the heads of working people. And they're doing this all over the world. And when you look at the kind of life that people could have, with the wealth that's been created by working people, and I mean, we got to understand the only way wealth gets created is through the labor of working people. Working people
right.
create all the wealth that exists in the world. And when you have all this wealth being transferred to bankers who skim the cream right off the top, they're loaning money to the oil companies, they're loaning money to the manufacturing companies that are doing business all over the world. Here in Minnesota, they closed down the Ford plant here in St. Paul, and they moved the operation to Thailand. All that was financed through banks. Ford borrows that money from banks. They pay interest on that money, and the workers are paid very little, and they'll give them credit cards, and those workers will be in debt just like American workers. And, it's a cycle that just keeps going on and on and on. And there's only one way to end it, and that's to end capitalism and have a socialist system where the workers, become the bosses, and where we have public banking rather than private banking. That's one thing that people should be struggling for right now. This would take care of, probably 80 to 90% of the world's problems if we brought the American banking system under public ownership and control. These bankers
right.
would no longer be able to finance all these wars all over the world. And, this would help create peace. We have the State Bank of North Dakota here. Our neighbors have the State Bank of North Dakota, the only state and public bank here in the United States. Why? Because workers struggled for that. They had a socialist party that went out and fought for that. And, that's what we need all over this country. Socialism is, this is what's going to benefit working people. If we even look at our health care system, our education system, every time we take up, a socialist program like public education, that works well for people. We could have a socialist health care system. That would work well for people, getting rid of the profits. And, everything we look at, any problem that we have, there you have profits causing our problems. The private profits of big banks, the private profits of manufacturing companies, the private profits of mining companies and the forestry
right.
industry, you name it, the energy industry. Look at the energy industry. They have no problem getting huge, huge loans from these banks to put up nuclear power plants. It cost $60 million to build a nuclear power plant in Michigan, the Big Rock plant, and yet it cost, you know, almost $1 billion to decommission the plant. And, you know, all that was financed by loans from banks that the ratepayers that buy this electricity are now going to have to pay. And they're going to pay it through the nose through rising electric rates. You know, and we can go through the whole system, and no matter what you look at, it's the exact same thing.
Alan, what I want to focus on the last part of our program, we have several more minutes, and then I'd like for you to give some contact information. When we look at the American Revolution that took place from 1965 to 1983, and actually the revolution ended in 1765 to 1783, and the revolution did end in 1781. But you can see that the people in the colonies, they were fighting for rights, and they wanted to make certain that they had the freedoms that they weren't experiencing under the British rule. And then under the then they created the Bill of Rights in 1791. We could see that people were looking at having rights that they weren't that they did not enjoy under the British rule, and much of what they were looking for, Alan, was just to be able to enjoy the natural rights, just to be able to live in a free and just society. But Alan, when we look at what those people were fighting for, what they fought for during the revolution, and where we are today, Alan, seem like all those gains, Alan, have been lost. Now, when we look at what they were fighting for 235 years ago, and we look at certain things such as the NDAA, Alan, this is really an assault working people all across the country. What this is doing is giving the rights to the government to be able to take away any rights that we have and just supposedly to protect us against terrorism. But we can see that the government itself, they're becoming the harbors of terrorism. Now, Alan, what we can, again, like I say, the National Defense National Defense Authorization Act, Alan, what they just recently did within the last, I think it was in the last week or so, that they voted on this again to reinstate it for 2014. Could you explain to our listeners the ramifications of NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act?
Well, the ultimate ramifications of that are that they're going to be able to jail American citizens and keep them in, locked up without any kind of rights or anything under habeas corpus. All they have to do is designate somebody as a threat to, you know, this country, and they can lock you up and do essentially whatever they want with you.
Right.
And but this is,
and the reason why they're doing this, Alan, is because capitalism is failing. They realize that millions and millions of people don't believe in it anymore.
The rich people never wanted working people to have any rights, as evidenced by they didn't want the Bill of Rights. So they never wanted these rights, and ever since the Bill of Rights was approved, they've been fighting tooth and nail to deprive us of those rights, and we've had to fight back for those rights. And it's the same thing now. If people don't stand up and fight for the rights that we still have, they're going to take our rights away, you know, little by little, and probably the pace will quicken. And we won't have the right to write a letter to the editor of a newspaper criticizing what this government is doing. We won't have the right to stand on a street corner to pass out a leaflet. In fact, in a lot of places, you can't even do that now without a cop coming up to you and knocking you around, you know. All these things where people are supposed to have, you know, be able to participate in their government and everything, very few people have any opportunity to participate in this government at all today. It's the lobbyists calling the shots, the lobbyists working for the big bankers and the Chamber of Commerce. They're calling all the shots in this country, and the people have no say. And unless people start to wake up and realize this, you know, we're going to wake up one day and we're not going to have any rights. People like me and you will be sitting in jail cells or worse. You know, you think about it. Look what they did in Chile. They took literally thousands of people out and murdered them. Well,
right.
That was all done by people that were trained by the United States down there in Fort Benning, Georgia, at the School of Americas. They call it something else now. I forget the exact name. But, I mean, if this government will train people to do this to people in other countries, does anybody really believe that they aren't training these people and these people haven't already been trained to do this to us right here in our own country? You know, look at the way the police are acting right now in this country. I just read, I forgot where it was, I think it was in Texas, some kid told a cop, he started mouthing off to him, and the cop started getting real arrogant and everything, and the kid says, ha ha, what are you going to do, shoot me? And the cop pulled out his gun and emptied his gun into him.
Right.
You know, this just happened, and I think in the past week or so.
It happened a week ago.
Yeah, things like this are going on all over in this country. The cops have literally been turned into murderers, and they want to do that because they want to make the people afraid of them. And these cops
right.
want to show that this is the way people get treated. Keep your mouth shut or you're going to get treated the same way. You know, who would have ever thought that a cop would pull out a gun and empty his gun into a kid? I mean, this was a kid, I think he was around 20 years old or something.
Yeah,
going to
college, I think he was 20.
Yeah, just for lipping off to him, the cop murdered him.
Right.
You know, this to most people, this doesn't even make any sense. If somebody
I call it state terrorism.
Yeah,
I call it state terrorism.
Terrorism.
What do you call it? Yeah.
It is terrorism. If somebody would have called me on the telephone and said this happened, I wouldn't have believed them. But, in fact, I had to look on the Internet until I found a bunch of newspaper articles. I didn't even believe that had happened. It seems so far-fetched, but it's not far-fetched. This can happen in any city, in any community across the country today. And people know this. And it's a very intimidating thing, and it's meant to be intimidating to keep people and keep people's mouths shut. You know, that's what
right.
it's all about.
Alan, the last thing I want to just get into, because we can see that this whole system is just collapsing. If it lasts for another 2 years, it would be really beyond me. And the reason why I say it's collapsing, because they're putting certain safeguards in place to protect themselves against the people within. They're not worried about, you know, any invasion. I don't think any country could come in and just invade this country. But they were worrying about within. Alan, what can working people do today to prepare themselves for what we can see this going to be taking? It's definitely going to take place within the next, you know, 3 to 4 years from now. But I think it could be even sooner than that. But what can working people do to prepare for this madness?
I don't think anybody's really thought it out too thoroughly, but I think that in general we got to look at what we have to do to take power, political and economic power, away from Wall Street. Unless we begin to think in those terms, we're in for a really rough ride, and things are only going to continue to worsen. These people in Wall Street, they have no shame. They will continue to try and make their big profits out of our problems. And they'll continue to do this. They don't care how bad the problems get, and they've created these problems in the first place. But now they're going to try and profit off of these problems. I mean, they profit off of things like food stamps. They profit off of poverty in every way that they can. You know, these people have no shame. And what the American people haven't really thought in terms of who has power. And that's what we got to begin to think about, that Wall Street is in power, and it's their lobbyists that are calling all the shots. I just read that the lobbyists passed out five times as much money as what is done during elections and campaign contributions to these politicians. You know, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars paying these people, bribing these politicians to do what Wall Street wants them to do. We got, as American people, we got to begin to think, do we want Wall Street to remain in power in this country? If not, then we got to begin to make plans to take power away from Wall Street, and that means organizing a new political party. It means getting organized to keep people out in the streets and protesting all this crap that's going on. And eventually, you know, we're going to have to, from these protests in the streets and at places of work and employment, we're going to have to start getting people that will start running for public office on another party ticket that represents working people, and that will seek to you know, find some solutions to the problems of working people. Things like, you know, a minimum wage that is a real living wage. We need to begin to fight for full employment so that everybody has a job. These are things that we will need even under socialism. So we might as well start to fight for these things right now. You know, I've been telling people, you know, the heck with the single-payer stuff with health care. Let's start waging a struggle for a national public health care system. You know, even Thomas Paine recommended a national health system way back in the, you know, at the time of the American Revolution. He advocated for an annual guaranteed income way back then, and we still haven't implemented either one of these things. And here was a guy, Thomas Paine, that was fighting for the interests of the common people, and, you know, what's happened, you know, we don't, our schools and everything, they don't even want us to know about Thomas Paine anymore. They don't even want us to really know about Thomas Jefferson. I think that Thomas Jefferson would be rolling in his grave today if he knew the things that were going on in this country, and he wasn't the greatest guy. But he had some concept of what democracy was supposed to be about. Thomas Paine had a better concept. But, you know, kids aren't learning about these people in school. They're not learning about the struggles. I've been talking to people that, you know, don't even know basic history about the working class struggles to build the unions right here in Minnesota. All that's been wiped out because they don't want people in this country to know that you win by fighting against the very greedy and corrupt corporations that are running this country. That's what they don't want to know, people to know.
Oh, one of the things you mentioned, you say we need another political party. Alan, when you consider the two corporate parties, what chance does another political party has in this country to be able to rise up and organize people? What chances are there?
Well, I think there's a good chance if people understand what they have to do. We have to be very organized. The only way to beat these people is through very good organization. And they've been beaten before. Here in Minnesota, we had the Socialist Minnesota Farmer Labor Party. This party elected two socialist governors. It elected members of Congress. It elected members of Congress. It controlled almost every single city council in the state, almost every school board and park commission and county commission. It controlled the state house and almost controlled the state senate. The people did this because they were fed up. They organized and they were able to accomplish this. They organized through what they called the Farmer Labor Association. And we're going to need something like this in this country today. I don't know, you know, people are going to, I don't know what you would want to call it, probably not a farmer labor association because there aren't that many family farmers left, but, you know, some kind of progressive political movement that will, you know, begin to organize to take power away from Wall Street is what we're talking about.
And Alan, how can people reach you? And we really appreciate you joining the program. We're out of time now. But could you let people know how they can reach you? People need to understand a revolution is happening, and that revolution is working against the best interests of working people. How can people reach you, Alan?
People can call me at 218-386-2432, or they can Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and they'll come across my blog, the Podunk blog, and all my contact information, email, and everything is there. I should
and
say,
Alan,
after
I want
the
last to tell you
program,
that millions...
I got half a dozen emails.
Why me?
After the last program a couple weeks ago, I got half a dozen emails.
That's great. Love hearing that. We look forward to having our listeners join us next week, this same time, on the Socialist Insight. Thanks again, Alan. Thank you, Ruth Ann. See you next week.
Yep, thanks for having me.
See you next week. Thank you.